everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you with the positive mind. Here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Bringing you ideas, concepts, things to think about. And we have been doing a series of programs about human sexuality and the evolution of the human. And here's what we believe. We believe, or think, from the research that we've done, that our history, what we've learned about ourselves, affects us in the present. So we want to understand what it is that we're born with. What's the stuff that we have that's running around as an imperative of the biological self that may or may not still be accurate. By understanding the past, we can understand the present a little better. We've been talking about the evolution of different things, including maturity, compassion, about human orgasm. We've talked about many different things. Today, we want to talk to you about communication. This whole idea of communication, what things we take for granted. What is the communication that takes place between your two cats? You know, you got two cats, you got two dogs, roof, roof. You know, row, row. A little grunt, you know, and the gorilla to his gorillettes. Or little monkeys. What do they? How do they communicate?
A lot of communication between animals is based on behavior that alters the chemistry in the brain of the other animal, the animal that's supposed to receive the communication. Pheromones, for instance, are a great, very effective way of communicating one's state of being, not just in terms of sexuality, but in terms of whether one is afraid, for instance, or angry.
So smell is what
smell
you're saying.
Is a way to affect the chemistry in such a way that you're communicating something.
Oh, so very good. So, you know, the very interesting, an effort to communicate is really seems to be vital between people who are living together or working together. One of the forms of communication we have is smell.
And we are not aware that we change the way we smell according to how we feel. In other words, if I'm upset, I don't necessarily register the fact that I'm smelling differently than when I'm not upset. And yet, people in the room with me, even below the level of their consciousness, they might be picking up that I'm upset. Even though I may not be saying anything, they may be perceiving it because some pheromones are in the air from my body that communicate that I'm upset. And this
is
how
people don't know what pheromones are, Roberta.
Oh, they are scent molecules. They are molecules that waft in the air, waft in the air, and they are secreted by the body of animals and humans, and the air picks them up, and they fly around the room, and then they land in another organism's nose, and that organism is given a signal. Now we're talking about a chemical signal, a message that says something about the one who secreted that molecule.
Sure, we all know
it's
when
it's a very important way of communicating.
We also know when a food smells bad, right? You pick up a piece of food that's been in the refrigerator. Shall I eat this or shall I not eat it? You smell it.
And, you know, there are people that don't smell good to us and other people who do. But that's a subjective thing. Someone may smell very good to us and not to others and vice versa.
You pick up something out of the refrigerator and you smell it. What do you smell for? You smell for rot. You smell for chemicals. Those things that are aversive to us, that we have an aversion to, very often are only just chemicals. I mean, feces, you know, is just a chemical smell. It's hard to believe it's such a chemical smell. Rotten eggs is a chemical smell.
It warns us of danger.
It maybe warns of its danger, right.
Well, whenever it smells bad, it means that there's a potential for getting sick or hurt or something like that.
So when we smell something that smells really bad, like somebody didn't flush the toilet or something like that, some part of us hesitates and says, oh, that's that smell. That means that there may be danger around because something is rotting or something might be around here. When we smell rotten eggs and we have that reaction, somehow the human body finds a negative response to sulfur. There are a number of different smells that we have reactions to, all signifying some kind of danger. It's a very interesting thing about people who are dying, I think it's with a liver disorder, that people have an acute sense of smell that they didn't have normally in their life.
Yes.
Suddenly, how would you explain that? Why would they suddenly get very sharp noses?
I guess probably, and I'm just guessing, because their immune system is so weakened at this point that they are so sensitive and anything could hurt them. Any little virus or bug that's in the air could cause major infection, so they are very sensitive to what they smell because it's a way in which the body gives them a signal to be careful.
So we communicate in many different ways. We communicate with smell, with touch, with sight, with, you know, what you see, and we communicate with words.
Body language.
Body language.
The way we move. The way we move is actually a powerful way of communicating. At the animal level, animals communicate probably 80% of their communication, other than pheromones, other than scent, is based on how they move their ears, their tail, or their entire body in the presence of another animal of that species or a different species. So for humans too, even though we don't realize it, according to how a person moves in front of us, the way they sit, the way they stand up, the way they walk, they are communicating something to us, and we perceive that message, but we don't necessarily attach a verbal meaning to it because the message is nonverbal. So we perceive something about a person and we don't necessarily interpret it in words, but our minds know something about that person from watching that person move.
It's the way a person moves in front of you, either aggressively or passively. Somehow your mind has a reaction, sometimes a bad reaction. Sometimes you want to pull away from them. Sometimes you want to attack them. Sometimes you have different feelings, very often because you're responding to a movement of theirs. Sometimes people smell a certain way. Why do you think people wear perfume? They wear perfume so that they could attract somebody else, because it's been kind of, they believe that this smell, this scent, will bring you closer to me, not further apart.
And also, perfumes, Armand, have a certain quality about them, whereby if I'm attracted to a certain perfume and I think that that smells nice on me, there must be a reason for it, meaning that that perfume, to me, communicates something about me. You see? So when I pick a perfume over another, something in the chemistry of that particular perfume is congruent with a message that I want to send out to other people. I mean, it's obvious, for instance, in the difference between perfumes that women wear and perfumes that men wear. You know, usually women like to smell a certain way and men like to smell a different way, and so that a woman is very unlikely to buy a men's perfume and vice versa. So, I mean, even when we pick a certain scent, even though it may not be coming out of our body, we're still communicating something to those around us by putting on that particular perfume.
So communication comes in many forms, and one of the forms of communication is smell. Smell is important. Movement is important. Smell of your own family. You know, people know what your family smells like. You can smell it. I mean, it's really amazing. I can smell cultures. You know, I know an Italian smell.
Yes, no, it's very true.
I don't think it's just the garlic.
No, it's very true, Armand, that when you land in Italy, when I land in Italy after I haven't been there in 6 months, first thing I do is, oh, smell of home, you know?
But you're talking about the environment. I'm talking about the people.
Sure, but I mean, once you land in Italy, you immediately smell the Italians.
You smell people. That's what mostly is around you.
Sure.
If you think about that, most dust, 90% of most dust in a house is human epithelial cells, you know?
Oh, wow.
Right?
Sure.
Is that going to have some message that it's going to communicate to us?
Yeah.
If there's that much skin, dead skin floating around, is it going to have some communication to it?
Armand, I'll never forget when I adopted my Sydney, my dog. I went to pick him up in Massachusetts. He was up for adoption. He needed a home, and this was a great Pyrenees, big, huge dog, 150 pounds, looks like a polar bear. So I entered this house where he lived, and he was not there in the first room, so I don't see him. But Armand, I'll never forget, I smelled him. I came into that house, and the first thought I had was, oh, my God, am I going to live with this smell? Because he smelled like a bear. Am I going to live with this smell for 15 years, and at the moment, I had a moment of doubt because it was so intense and strong. Then, of course, after he was living in my house, I got used to it and didn't smell it as much. But I'll never forget the first meeting with my Sydney was this powerful scent of bear that he had that was pervasive in that house. And yet, even though he smelled like bear, it really did communicate a sense of a protective being, a creature that was protective. And even though I had a moment of doubt because it was so intense, I liked it. I fell in love with it, and he was my dog for 15 years almost.
I know, and I know he died recently, but yeah. I can tell you, if that smell would have passed you by, without you even knowing it, Roberta, if that smell was just somewhere on the outside, not bear, but, you know, the Sydney smell, you would suddenly feel a calming come over you.
Yes.
Because that smell reminds you.
I have a confession to make. I saved a bit of his hair in a bag, and every now and then I put my nose in it.
Just to smell Sydney.
Yes.
Yes, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. You know, there are this thing I used to have when I was a kid. We had an aunt who made orange cake. And she made this orange cake. She made a vanilla cake that had an orange flavor in it. It was so good. And it was also filled with a lot of love.
Yes.
And I remember the smell of this. I remember I said, oh, Auntie's making one of those cakes. And it meant something to us. Then came a perfume called Shalimar. And I remember when Shalimar first hit the market, someone would be on the subway and I'd smell it. And it would remind me of my aunt.
Mm.
It reminded me just of that orange cake. So I looked at the ingredients, and there was vanilla, and there was orange, and there was a bunch of other things. But the actual smell of the perfume reminded me of things that I would have had and which made me feel good.
Yes.
Smell is an important communicator, much more than anybody thinks.
Yes.
When people are in a relationship and they eliminate their smell by too frequent bathing or showering, they very often lose a bond that people can have with each other. Don't you love the smell of your lover? Don't you love the smell of your husband, your wife, the person you live with, your children? Don't you love that smell? If you don't love that smell, if you meet somebody and then you smell them and you say, ooh, would you please take a shower? Ooh, would you get rid of that smell? Forget about it.
Yeah.
Don't try to pursue this relationship. Don't spend your life changing the smell of the person you love. It's only one communicator. This is one that we have in common with all animals. Smell, movement, touch. These are some we depend on that are really fantastic. Today we're also going to talk about communication through verbal communication. We're also going to go there, but before we do, let's go back for a second to talk about the different smells of animals. You know, one of the things that an animal will do, a dog or cat will do, is smell the genitals of another animal. You know, one of the first things they do, you know, an animal, a dog walks up to another dog, he starts sniffing right away.
And there's a lot of communication that goes on.
Lots of stuff.
Through that, of course.
What are they smelling?
Well, they're smelling all kinds of things because whatever scent they pick up tells them, I guess, the condition of health the other animal is in. It tells them if the animal is in estrus or is fertile or is not or is what age or you know, all kinds of things they pick up. They pick up, I guess, whether an animal is friendly or not, right? Whether an animal is aggressive or not, whether an animal is young or old. God knows, but certainly.
Are they sniffing the genitals?
Oh, yeah. Dogs, it's the first thing they do. In fact, some dogs even do that to people. The first thing they do when they meet a person is they put their nose right up there, and people get embarrassed without realizing that this is perfectly normal behavior for a dog to do. Because that, remember, the dog doesn't speak, doesn't ask questions. So the best way for a dog to figure out who you are, whether you're friend or foe, or whatever the dog needs to know about you, he or she is going to pick it up through smelling you, most likely. Because also dogs don't have very great visual sense. So even looking at you, they can't, you know, figure out what you are. But when they smell you, a dog's nose can pick up, I believe us humans can pick up probably about 100,000 different scents. And a dog's sense of smell can pick up something like 10 million different scents. So their nose is a great receiver of communication. And I often, in fact, wonder how difficult it must be for a dog or a cat or an animal with such a developed sense of smell, how difficult it must be to live, for instance, in New York City and to walk around the street with all of these people and all of these cars and all of this, you know, the trash receptacles and everything that smells so strongly. What is the poor dog's nose? Imagine if you were constantly bombarded in your ears and eyes with millions of bits of communication of messages, visual and auditory, constantly. That's what it must be like for a dog to live in the city.
This is Armand Amil with Roberta Ratti. We're talking about forms of communication that we have inherited that go all the way back in time. We are no different than the dogs. We've also been talking about human sexuality. One of the things that we find is that the animals will smell each other's genitals. I mean, this is the smell tells you where the animal has been. It could tell you if it's mated recently. It tells you its health. It tells you its age. It tells you a whole bunch of things. So a dog sniffing a dog is a very, very important communication style. Why? Because they can't say, how are you? Where were you today? What were you doing? Who do you hang out with? What don't they have? They don't have the verbal skills.
But the interesting aspect is they can't lie. Words can lie, right? We can tell lies with words, but smell cannot.
So some dogs must powder their genitals. As humans do, right?
Well, what they do, actually, yes.
Humans lie with their smells.
They do, yes. And dogs will, for instance, roll themselves when they find something really smelly.
Like fish.
Yeah, they might roll themselves in it to camouflage their own scent or something. They pick up scents from some other things as a way to camouflage their own.
Sure, you ever watch cat burying its duty in a cat box?
Right.
It's very fastidious. It's going to hide this smell, not going to let anybody get at this smell. It doesn't want it to let people know about it.
Right.
At other times, when it wants the smell to be communicated, it'll spray it all over the house.
Sure.
So we have smell, but we have the absence. So we, like all other animals, have smell. We have touch, which is obvious. You can tell from the touch of another being what their intention is. We have the visual, which will tell you especially about movement and attitudes. Now let's talk about communication. Besides whales and dolphins, there are humans have a complex system, and I guess bees and ants, there are some kind of communication thing that we have going that is very intricate and very special.
But the question is, why did we develop such a sophisticated tool for communication?
Let's start with the fact that we have a very sophisticated tool of communication. So sophisticated that you, my dear audience, are using this sophisticated skill right now. There would be no radio if there were no verbal skills. You couldn't be listening. Dogs don't have radio.
Right.
They don't tune into cat radio. Oh, wait a minute. Cat radio. WBAR. Hey, Janet.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have cat radio. They don't have horse radio. You don't have this.
Right.
So there has to be something about our verbal skills. We have very, very special verbal skills. We can talk. We can communicate like almost no other being.
No other being, for sure.
Yeah, well, I've heard talk about the dolphin communication and the whale communication.
Oh,
the
but
bees' communication.
Nothing as sophisticated
as
ours.
And the ants' communication. And I don't think it's as sophisticated as ours. So why would we have developed such an important... Why would we have developed such a complex system of communication? This becomes very interesting because it goes along with the series we've been doing on the study of human sexuality.
Well, we can speculate that it's not enough to grunt to your mate. It's not enough to yell and scream, and it's not enough to whisper. I mean, it seems that the more extensive and the more sophisticated a vocabulary is in a particular person. In other words, if we listen to someone and their communication is very sophisticated and very complex and very cared for, meaning the person puts a lot of effort into choosing the words and chooses the right words and has the right intonation and rhythm, breathing and everything, we not only understand what the person is saying, but we also understand something about the mind of that person. And the more sophisticated a vocabulary is, the more the person will come across as a good potential mate. In other words, we tend to prefer someone who speaks with more intelligence and sophistication rather than less. We will pick a mate that has great verbal skills over a mate that has less great verbal skills. And some people will be so turned off by a mate that doesn't speak in a way that's sophisticated enough that the looks of that person or anything else about that person will completely not matter. Because once that, we've all heard someone say, well, once she or he opens her mouth, his mouth, it just all becomes intolerable.
It was kind of interesting during the movies when the talkies were around, before the talkies came in.
What talkies?
Silent movies were there, right? In silent movies, we had many major stars.
Right.
But then as soon as they started doing talkies, which is movies with sound, a whole bunch of stars just disappeared because they couldn't compete, because once you heard their voice, you were completely turned off to them. For as long as they were silent stars, you liked them, imagining their voice, but some voices are so horrendous to the person who is listening to them that they'll get turned off to it.
Right.
Now, why would we have developed such verbal skills? It can't just all be about being a better mate. It has to be something else. Let's start with who started this whole thing off about talking. Who started this? How did it happen? Let's go back to the woman 140,000 years ago.
That's the magical number.
Here we go again. 140,000 years ago. Roberta, let's see how quickly you could do this review.
I am speculating that the women found themselves in this difficulty of having children that were that had heads that were too large to pass through the birth canal, and there was a need to figure out a solution to the problem. And perhaps the way in which women started communicating was among each other, woman to woman, trying to ask for help, trying to figure out a solution, trying to warn another female, trying to express something.
Just in case you haven't heard us before, 140,000 years ago, children with big heads was not an anomaly. People were developing larger heads to accommodate bigger brains because this was the evolution of the human. But at the same time, it did not have a corresponding bigger pelvis. So at one point in history, there was this conundrum, there was this funneling where all of a sudden a bottleneck. People were dying because they were having sex and not being prepared to develop the baby with the larger head because the pelvises were too small, especially on the younger women. So younger women developed the ability to put together the fact that sex leads to babies, and then the ability to say, I'm going to try to not have babies just randomly. I'm going to try to plan it out somehow. So the way that they did that was they hid their estrus. Now, estrus was something that was when a woman was ready, a female was ready for sex, she would put out this smell, communicate this smell and other signals that would ready a male. And any male in the same species would be ready for her and mount her and have sex. Now the woman says, but I don't want to have sex this way. I don't want to just have every male coming in, so I want to control the men, and what I'm going to do, I'm going to hide my smell. Mind you, they hid the communication. I'm going to not smell when it's estrus time. So they did that, and the males kind of said, okay, now I can't smell you. How am I going to know when it's ready to have sex? Males turned out they had to do something. Human male and male became ready for sex all the time.
Which means that the way a female smells is a turn-on for a human male pretty much all the time.
All the time.
Right.
So if a woman smells like she's ready, then the male will always be responsive,
right,
supposedly.
Right.
Okay, so now the men are responsive, and the women are saying, okay, human females, this is for survival. I want to be able to have sex when I want to have sex, not when you feel like having sex, she says to the men. So she makes certain conditions, and she says to the man, I will do it, but as a human, I need to have a male who's going to be a mate, who's going to be with me. He has to help me in some way, bring up the babies, take care of the food. She is so debilitated by what it takes to have a human child that she says, I'm losing all of this iron, go out and get me some food. Male goes out and says, look, I want to come home to you because I want to have sex with you whenever I feel like having sex. I want to be able to have you there, so I'm going to go out and I'm going to earn these things for you. I'm going to fill myself with testosterone. I'm going to go on the hunt. I'm going to bring you food. He comes back with food, and he says, okay, now I'm ready. And she says, no, I need more than that. I need help with the babies.
Mind you, all of this that you're, you know, describing in a very visual way, Armand, you're attaching words to all of it that didn't exist. In fact,
right,
they never
no
spoke, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. There was no words, not just between them, but
thank
no
you.
Words in their heads.
Absolutely.
So it was all done through ways of communicating other than speech. And that's precisely why we're thinking that speech became so important and developed primarily among women. First of all, okay, women stayed back in the cave or nearby the cave with the children and stayed together with other women. Men had to go out hunting with other men. So why would speech develop more among women? Let's explore that.
We're going to go into that in just a couple of minutes, my friend. This is Armand Demeaux with Roberta Atti. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll bring you more information. But first, a little music in between. We'll be right back. Schiller, you're listening to, S-C-H-I-L-L-E-R, from Germany. This is Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atti, with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. We're talking about another part of our communication on human sexuality and understanding about human sexuality and how it affected human evolution. I think this is very important. No, we are no longer mandated by our biological imperatives. There are certain suggestions and urges that we have that I think follow what we inherited, but we have the ability to deal with it and control it in some way. We could turn around and say, no, I'm not just going to do that. I'm not going to have random sex. I'm not going to kill my neighbor. You know, I'm not going to take away his possessions. We have ways, and we develop rules in life so that we could inhibit ourselves and our urges so that we could have a better relationship, better society, and so on and so forth. In order to do that, humans developed speech. Speech is very different than the way most animals communicate, right? Speech itself, this complex using of words. You think you go from cave drawings, where people just grunted and drew things on a cave, showing things. People understood. Now we have words. How did words form? What do you think, Roberta? What do you think was the origin of words?
Well, I think, Armand, that if you think back to a time when there are no words, when there are only sounds, perhaps, to convey certain states of being, and then you picture the interactions among members of the tribe, of the group, envision the men out in a group on a hunt. They're stalking a prey, whether it's a big prey or small prey. They're not going to be talking, because the most important aspect of stalking is being silent and quiet so that the prey does not hear you. If men went about hunting while having a chat with their companions, I doubted that any self-respecting prey would stick around for very long, because as soon as the prey would hear the group of men on the path, the prey would run away. Okay, now envision the women. Some of them have children, some of them have babies, some of them are nursing, some of them are older females who have been around a while, have a lot to share, have a lot to teach perhaps. Some of them are, you know, all ages, and they are gathering. They're gathering fruit, they're gathering roots, foliage, berries, small insects, you know. So here they are. Well, certainly the roots and the berries are not going to run away if the women talk to one another. Not only that, it's kind of boring to gather. You know, gathering is not exciting like hunting. Gathering, it's a boring activity. You go from plant to plant and you pick the berries and you put them in a small bag. So you're bored, but next to you have your sister or your other female friend. And it comes natural to perhaps engage in some kind of communication with them, trying to break the boredom. Plus, you have children. Now, you see your child running off. You know that if the child runs too far, maybe there is dangerous animals. So you want to make sure you call the child back. So you want to develop some kind of verbal skill to control your children at a distance. You may have a baby on your back. You can't run after the toddler, 2 years old, who's already running off from you. You want to be able to control that child. And how are you going to do it? You're going to do it verbally. Plus, you know that your sister or your aunt died giving birth to a child just a while ago, and you have an idea or something that perhaps can help other women in the tribe not suffer the same fate. Perhaps you've come to some conclusion. Perhaps you have something to share. You're going to strive to develop a way of communicating while you're gathering. So it's much more likely that language developed among females while they were socializing and working with other females rather than with males, especially because the activities and the work that females engaged in were really congruent with verbal expression.
And the human baby stays with the human mother much longer than other babies do of other species, don't they?
Yes, the human baby is born completely dependent and completely unable to support itself. And in fact, any human baby, if left to its own devices, would die. There's no way it could survive.
So you want to be able to tell the human baby it's okay to play with the kittens, but don't play with the Tyrannosaurus.
Right.
Right? Don't you see a Tyrannosaurus there? Don't go trying to feed it.
Exactly. And it makes perfect sense that women would be the ones developing these verbal skills because of necessity, and because women perhaps were the teachers of, you know, early teachers must have been women if men were out on the hunt. And when men were not hunting, Armand, since hunting is such a high energy expenditure activity and very dangerous as well, probably when the men are not hunting, they're resting, they're taking care of their wounds that they have suffered during the hunt, and if men are not hunting, they may be warring, they may be fighting, competing with other men of different groups, so they may have wounds and things whereby they need to lie and rest. So it's unlikely that men would have developed language because they didn't need to as much as women did. And so I believe, and I think I share this opinion with anthropologists and other researchers, I believe that women were the originators of human expression,
and
verbal
women,
expression.
And women were the first, humans were the first who had a brain big enough to be able to take complex tasks like thinking and communicating.
Yes.
And assimilate it and use it. We were the smart ones. Do you know what I mean? I mean, humans were, they did, this is what, it all started with bigger heads, because bigger heads meant bigger brains, and bigger brains meant let's try something different. Let's try communicating a different way. It's an interesting thing, just to bring you into the present, that one of the great studies that we've seen is they've tested hormone levels among women. And they find that when women talk to women, they increase their serotonin.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because if you have an increase in serotonin, you have an increased sense of well-being. Serotonin is valued by women as a good feeling. Men who are on the hunt may not want an increase in serotonin, right?
No, Roberta? They wouldn't. They would want an increase in dopamine rather than serotonin.
Men are dopamines.
They like dopamine.
They like dopamine because dopamine helps them be more aggressive.
Yes, because also men have more serotonin to begin with because they have more muscle mass, and having more muscle mass, they have more serotonin available to them.
And men don't lose their serotonin.
Right, they don't lose it as much as women do.
Women lose their serotonin and need to replenish it, and one of the ways they found to replenish serotonin is through conversation. Listen, you people out there, did you ever wonder why two women could stay on the phone for 40 minutes and just hang out on the phone and just talk and talk and talk? Look at your teenage daughter, who will be on the phone endlessly. What's going on? Little do you know, this is not about communication because they're not really talking about anything. But they are regenerating their serotonin. They are actually feeling great and feeling better and better. One of the reasons that women go to psychotherapy and men don't go as much is because even in psychotherapy, in the process of psychotherapy, more serotonin is released by the communication with the therapist because you're talking.
Right.
So talking has a positive effect. You were given a reward. More serotonin if you talk. Therefore, talk more. Also, you get other great gains from talking and communicating. You can now share the experience of other people. You can now share the experience. You could share the learning.
You could teach.
You can teach.
And you can control other people's behavior up to a point. Through speech, especially children. But also, now I'm thinking about verbal communication between mates, Armand. How important is that? Well, it's a stereotype, I guess, to say that women believe men don't talk enough and men believe that women exceedingly like to talk, right? Am I right in that? Men tend to make a joke out of how much women like to talk. And women make a joke out of how men, you know, don't like to talk.
And it's a funny thing because, you know, it's almost like we're contradicting their nature. But we did find the following. We did find that men, if they access their anima, the female side of themselves, which is very hard to do for men, easier for women, they do find a part of them that does get into relaxing and being able to have conversation and enjoy conversation. It's just not their natural state.
Right. What I'm learning, Armand, is that men with men prefer to engage in silent activity and bond through sharing the experience.
And watching things.
Watching things or doing things together.
That's right.
Creates a bond. Whereas women, even if they're doing something together, so let's say they're doing something, they're engaged in some activity, they'll be describing it verbally or they'll be having a conversation while engaging in the activity, and the bond is created through that conversation, as you just explained. But now let's look at mates, a man and a woman having a conversation. What does that accomplish? What is expected? How easy is it? Well, it may or may not be that easy. Women, of course, based on what we just said, have been selecting males that can talk, that can listen, that can communicate with them through their anima self in a verbal way whereby emotions, feelings, thoughts, what happened during the day is communicated verbally, not so much because it is so important for the person to know what happened at work today, but because the fact that that person is sitting and listening to me shows that he's interested in me, regardless of whether he's interested in what I have to say.
Now, why for the survival of the human species would we develop this thought of having interest in me as an important criteria? Well, if he's interested in me, he's interested in my babies too.
Right.
Because interest and showing interest and compassion means that he is going to be a better father. He's going to be a better communicator, and we're going to bring up better children, and we're going to help the human race survive.
Because I guess women figured out early on that a man's nature is not talkative and that a man's nature is not caring necessarily unless he is gently pushed in that direction, gently coerced, should I say, to get into that behavior in order to be acceptable. Again, females of the human species have had a great deal of power through human evolution on males' behavior, always because of that initial choice of denying sex to the male and expecting something from the male, whether it was behavioral or whether it was a gift or whether it was in the form of meat, expecting something in exchange for sex, which is what the male really is interested in. And I'm not, I mean, I know I sound really politically incorrect when I say these things, but I'm talking about how things evolved, not how things should be or how we would like them to be. On one hand, we want a hunter who is good at hunting, which means he has to be silent. He has to be cruel. He has to be merciless. He has to be non-empathic. We want that because we want the meat. But on the other, we want a husband who comes home and is able to talk to us in a gentle, caring way. And that requires that he makes a leap in his brain, that he is able to change the chemistry of his brain to accommodate the different phases of daily life. One phase requires that he's merciless and silent. The next phase requires that he's talkative and caring. How does he make that leap? Well, women have expected men to acquire the skills to make this not only a possibility, but to make this happen day after day in a relationship, in a marriage. Women expect this out of men.
And you know that, but there is a tremendous reward, Roberta. There is a tremendous reward for the man to be able to communicate and understand, because in the best communications that a man has, he's doing one of two things. He is either working the female, he's making her feel good by using words strategically, as many men do. They carefully work at feeding somebody what they want and giving them what they want, and in their mind they're saying, well, I see, I think she wants this, so I'll give her this, and they really don't mean anything they're saying. A lot of men talk. They'll just, she wants me to talk, so I'll just talk. But then there's this other aspect, which is love. Now, this other aspect is the payoff for men. When men find that a relationship where you communicate results in this being able to access both the male and female part of the male self, which means he could both be strong and he could be soft. He could be tender. He gets to feel some of that beauty of his femininity along with his masculinity. He gets to feel this soft part. And in this soft part, he not only feels caring, but he gets something else that males don't get if they're not sensitive. He gets loved. It's an interesting thing if you think about most animals. The alpha male, with all of his females around, and all the females come around and they're admiring him, adoring him, and raising their hindquarters ready for him whenever he's ready, does he feel any of this admiration coming in his direction? No. Most of them are just, I'm the alpha male, this is my job, I'm taking what I want, and you don't receive any of the caring. You receive some kind of affection, but really your job is to take what you want. But if you're a human male, and you get to the point where you can feel and let yourself feel the love coming back, you have to do that through your anima side. You have to do that through your female side. Now you open up. Now you say, let me understand what she wants. What's it like to be her? And now in order to experience what it's like to be her, you have to feel more vulnerable, receptive. Now you feel receptive and you start feeling a feeling that is not accessible to me, the male hunter. You get this feeling of caring coming in your direction. Love coming in your direction, you feel warmed and embraced, just as the person you love feels warmed and embraced when you communicate with her. You start feeling the beauty of this. So there's a great payoff.
So do you think that part of that is it gives the male also a sense of completeness in himself that perhaps he cannot even imagine when he does not have this kind of exchange?
The word is safety. Men, in order to feel safe, will feel it through a mating where they feel relaxed. They have to come down. If the man's always on guard and he's always on the hunt and he comes home and he's exhausted and he goes to sleep and he has no communication and he wakes up in the morning and gets back in the field and starts working again, he's never a safe being.
Right.
Men don't feel safe.
Never.
Almost never.
Right.
But if you allow yourself to access that part of you, the compassionate, loving part of you, you get a feeling of safety which is like a child being held by a parent.
Sure.
Which the women have access to.
Sure. For a woman, that's a rather daily accessible feeling, accessible state. And it's so much so that it's hard to imagine not to have that so accessible.
Most men never feel safe.
That's very interesting. And now I'm also thinking about people I work with where let's say that the relationship is such whereby the man in the relationship, has been criticized by his wife or by his woman for a long time, so much so that the relationship is based on her constantly being criticizing him and yelling at him and telling him how bad he is and how he is a failure or how he is, you know, doesn't succeed or this or that. And so she, through her voice and through her words, but especially the tone of voice, is now communicating to him through the very vehicle through which normally she would give him access to her. Now she gives him access to an anima state that is wounding for him. And what I have seen in these men, in these relationships, is that they shut down to the world. Because now the one piece of them, the part that is the part where they could feel that safety that you were describing, even that part now is no longer safe. In fact, is the most wounding probably, because right where they should go for comfort is where they find the criticism. These men are so shut down to the world and to life that it's a very sad thing to see. And it's not even what the woman says to them. She could even be saying, you know, whatever, but it's even in her voice, the tone of voice. We don't realize how important the tone of voice is and how when we speak to a mate, perhaps he picks up even more from the tone than from the words what we're trying to communicate, and the criticism comes across as much as the love does.
And what happens to men is sometimes their refusal to learn a different way leads them to this place because they can't even communicate it to their mate that this is something wrong. And so something that may have started as a man just shutting down against women in general or against communication winds up coming back and biting him in the butt. Or it just could have happened in early childhood where there was no communication skills. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right. To watch a man feel lost and feel vacant,
yeah,
and to see that terrible, terrible sadness,
it is,
which
really,
I see in so many men.
It is, and it's so, so difficult to explain even to the woman. Let's say this is a couple who asks for help. It's so difficult to explain to the woman that for as long as you keep hurting him with your voice and with your words, he's never going to give you what you so much want from him, and it becomes a vicious circle.
And it's not but nobody's fault. I mean,
no.
It's not our fault. It's
just communication.
No. We have to get going. Hey, this is Armand Amil with Roberta Atiyah. A lot more to say about this. But we will be back with you, and we will continue this series. If you needed to reach Roberta, you could do it at Roberta for Health, R-O-B-E-R-T-A, for Health.
Number four
in the middle, at AOL.com. You could go to my website, thepositivemind.com, and take a check at what we've got there. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atiyah. We will be back with you soon, my friends. If you want a copy of today's program or for this entire series that we've done, call 212-757-4488.
Sit down.